welcome to your talking newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding area. I'm Bill, and this is the Red Satin programme for Saturday, 24th of April, 2021. I do hope you're all well and staying safe. The music this week is a medley of two traditional Irish tunes, The Ashplant and Red-Haired Lass, played by the marvellous flautist Jacqueline Hines. It's taken from her CD, Silver and Wood. Jacqueline is a leading exponent of folk styles in the UK and is a lecturer in folk and flute at both Morley College in London and the Leeds College of Music. She's kindly allowed us to use this track, which of course I will play in full at the end of the programme. This week, as usual, we have the news stories and radio listings, and then Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes. Following this, we have a couple of articles from the current edition of Hearts Life magazine. The first is about Eric Blair, also known as George Orwell, of course, and how his time living in rural Hertfordshire inspired one of his most famous books, Animal Farm. The second article, read by Sue, celebrates Women's History Month by offering short biographies of 10 Hearts women who were pioneers and social activists. We start with the news, and our readers this week are Caroline, Penny, Bob, and Fiona.
Hello, my name's Caroline, and my first story this week details how Parish Council reveals £250,000 financial scandal over 11 years. More than a quarter of £1 million was illegally paid out of Parish Council coffers over the course of a decade, it has been revealed. Colney Heath Parish Council identified over £250,000 had been paid in ultra vires payments during the late John Dean's tenure as parish clerk. Ultra vires is an act which requires legal authority, but is done without being granted, and these payments are termed invalid because they are not approved by the council. A catalogue of financial misdemeanours was uncovered between September and December 2015 by an interim parish clerk following Mr Dean's death earlier that year, and Hearts Police were called in to investigate the following January. It was established that a total of £254,767.29 had been paid out between April 1, 2004 and July 10, 2015, representing between 15 and 25% of the parish precept every year over that period. This was not picked up as audit reports were posted to the clerk's home address and not subsequently reviewed by the council. The clerk made verbal reports to the council on these audits, and there is no evidence councillors were ever provided with copies. It was discovered that John Dean had no training or experience in local government and had not undertaken any qualifications for the role and lacked knowledge of financial transparency, legislation, payment regulation and how to manage monies in the public purse. No contract of employment was ever issued and no references were taken up. An investigation into the parish finances revealed over £100,000 was taken in petty cash with no records of what this money was used for. £5,930.80 in cash was paid out without authorisation for cleaning the parish office, and cash bonuses of £16,140.37 were paid over the period without approval. The clerk had also approved his own overtime of between 20 and 30 hours a month and a pay rise of 52%, and he inflated his salary on a letter he himself signed to obtain a mortgage. There was no record of Mr. Dean being approved as an essential car user, despite this being paid monthly, resulting in an overpayment of £13,319.20. Ultra vires payments had been made to various organisations and individuals, including Smallford's Residents Association, the Scout and Guide Association, Charles Morris Hall, Treasure Tots Nursery, the Neighbourhood Plan Project Manager, Colney Heath Village Hall and Colney Heath Football Club. He approved all payments and amounts without referring to councillors and without an appropriately approved scheme of delegation in place. Treasure Tots was set up following incorrect advice in 2004 and closed in July 2016 after it was confirmed the parish council did not have the power to operate a children's nursery. Mr. Dean was also employed as the nursery's secretary for 5 hours a week between 2005 and 2015, during which time he gave himself a 91% increase in his hourly rate. Parish Council Chair Councillor Peter Cook said, "I am pleased that Council have now resolved to conclude this matter so that we can focus on the current needs of our electorate rather than previous misdeeds. I believe the report highlights a disappointing decade of financial and process irregularities." The challenge was brought to our knowledge from autumn 2015, and then we had to wean the organisations off of what had become custom and practice and expectation over many years. I would especially like to thank those councillors who kept the focus on good governance and transparency of decision-making, especially after involving Hearts Constabulary in 2016 and the new full-time clerk for her extensive research to support the wide-reaching claim over the last few years. The Parish Council has been offered a settlement of £45,900 for the losses by insurers Zurich, which will be allocated proportionately throughout the parish. Although further investigation could have continued, it was deemed that it was in the best interest of the council and the electorate for the settlement offer to be accepted.
Hello, this is Bob here. The first article is under the section This Week, and the heading is University Student Digs World War One Trench in St. Albans Garden for Film Project. It's not every day you ask your parents if you can build a World War One trench in the garden. When faced with the dilemma of how to complete his final year BA film production degree project, Chris Richards decided to film at home in St. Albans rather than on campus at the University of Winchester. However, that meant digging an authentic trench to help honour his great-grandfather, Lewis Blackman, and tell the story of the largely forgotten but crucial role signallers played during the conflict. It was all built by hand with hand tools, which made it all the more realistic, said Chris. A lot of big film companies just get a digger in to dig out a trench and it's far too clean and tidy, but doing it by hand, it looks far more natural. It also gave Chris a greater understanding of what life was like for those serving on the front line during the Great War. "It makes you realise what strenuous work it was," said Chris. "They were lucky they had a battalion of men to work on one particular trench. But with just two people doing even a small section of trench brought home how much effort went into making these trench lines and systems and the infrastructure that went into that." The 22-year-old former Beaumont school pupil had been planning to film a short documentary stroke drama based on his relative's experience as a signaller in the Royal Fusiliers during the First World War. With the arrival of the COVID pandemic, he suddenly found himself in a situation where compromises would have to be made on his final year project. "The restrictions put in place by the university meant we were given a choice to either film on campus in the facilities that are available there, or go home and film in your own house," said Chris. Undeterred, Chris decided to construct a World War One trench at his family home in Oakwood Drive after persuading his parents to allow him to dig up part of the back garden. "This is my final thing at uni, so I thought I'd better make the most of what I can do," said the creative student. "My parents were eventually very happy to let me do it, and they were very helpful throughout the process of building. And my brother as well was out digging with me in the garden in the rain and the cold. It was worth it in the end." Fence panels blown down in the wind earlier in the year were recycled to build up the sides of the trench, meaning they didn't have to dig down so far. "I thought it would be very difficult to build the entire trench down into the ground because those were over 6 foot deep. Because they had to be," explained Chris. "So I thought to make it a little easier, I'd dig the very bottom of the trench and the fire step, which is where one would stand for sentry duty or where one would sit when at rest. I built the rest of it above ground as a set with supports and then covered over the top with earth. It looks surprisingly good, actually. It took 3 days or so to construct, through the wind, the cold, the rain, and even snow. Being an extra on Sam Mendes' critically acclaimed World War I movie 1917 also helped with contacts to make his homemade film set more realistic. His trench comes complete with sandbags, wire and props, and set dressing from a professional props and design company. Chris has been shooting scenes in recent weeks and even has a full authentic signaller's uniform to wear for the film. Signalers had to keep communications going under fire and make sure there was coordination between different units, particularly during major attacks, explained Chris. It was an absolutely vital role, but also very dangerous. You were trying to mend a cable that had been blown to bits by a German shell, but at the same time, you had to keep an eye out for snipers and machine gun posts. So in fact, it was almost, if not more dangerous than charging over the top, because at least then you had a rifle at the ready to shoot back if necessary. But as a signaller, your main focus was trying to get these communications to work. Chris added, signallers have been largely ignored, which is a great shame because they were exceedingly brave, just as the regular infantry going over the top and all the gallant heroes you hear about. But you don't hear about the signallers who were doing just as vital a role. That's why I thought I need to set this straight, particularly with the personal element of my grandfather having served as one. And there are two photographs accompanying the article. One is of Chris Richards in costume in his World War I trench. The second picture is of Chris peering over the top of the trench with a gun, a rifle pointing through barbed wire.
Hello, my name is Fiona and my first story is about the up-and-coming local election. More than 300 candidates standing for county council. 300 political hopefuls across Hearts are battling it out for a place on the county council as the countdown to polling day continues. Currently, four of the county council seats in St Albans are held by the Conservatives and four by the Liberal Democrats, with one held by Labour and one by an independent. All 10 county council seats in the borough will be contested by the Conservative, Green, Labour and Liberal Democrat parties, and Reform UK candidates will also be standing in the St Albans North and St Albans South divisions. Independent councillor Roma Mills, who took the St Albans North seat from the Lib Dems in a 2018 by-election, standing as a Labour candidate, will not be standing for the county council position in the May the 6th elections. And Conservative councillor Sue Featherston will be standing down from the St Stephen's seat. Across Hearts, there are 327 candidates who have registered to stand as county councillors. The Conservatives and the Labour Party have candidates standing in every one of the council's 78 divisions, and the Lib Dems are standing in every seat except one in North Ware. The Green Party, who do not have a single seat on the council, have 62 candidates listed across the county. Each are hoping for a place on the county council, which is responsible for a wide range of services, including education, social services, waste disposal, public health, and even the fire service. Currently, the Conservatives on the county council have a majority of 20, holding 49 seats compared to the Lib Dems' 18 and Labour's 9 and 2 independents. But opposition parties will be keen to make gains in a number of seats where the margins are tight. There are 12 seats across the county where councillors were elected last time with a majority of less than 5%, including 7 held by Conservatives. But regardless of the political results, there will be a number of new faces in the council chamber next month. 20 sitting councillors are not standing. Among those stepping down this time are Executive Member for Resources and Performance, Councillor Ralph Sangster, and Executive Member for Public Health, Councillor Tim Hutchings.
Hello, this is Penny. Teenage Suicide Prevention Charity appoints its first ambassador. A charity that raises money to tackle teen suicide has appointed its first ambassador. Founded in March 2019 in memory of Ollie Lee, a 16-year-old student who took his own life the previous year, the Ollie Lee Trust aims to reduce suicide rates by funding training, education, and support. Now the Trust has chosen Oliver Morehouse, a young businessman who is known to many local teenagers due to his role as managing director of the Menspire Salons Group, which has male grooming salons in St Albans, Harpenden, Radlett and Watford. Oliver, who is born and bred in St Albans, has battled his own mental health issues. He recently began a small documentary series posting videos which share an insight into his journey with mental health over the past 10 years, with the aim of showing others that there is a way through difficult times with the correct help. Michelle Lee, founder of the Ollie Lee Trust, said, "We are thrilled and delighted to announce that Oliver Morehouse has become our ambassador. Oliver will be a tremendous asset to the Ollie Lee Trust, and we are so pleased to be travelling on our journey together." Oliver said, "I am delighted to be supporting the Ollie Lee Trust. From the minute I met the team, I was inspired by their energy and determination to make a difference in helping to reduce the rate of teenage suicide and self-harm through training, education and support. This is a subject that profoundly resonates with me due to my own ongoing journey. So I'm proud to be associated with a charity that helps with mental health and well-being." The Trust's planned events for 2020 had to be cancelled due to the pandemic, but will resume in July 2021 with a football tournament. In the meantime, it remains committed to raising both awareness of the growing problem of teenage suicide and mental health, and has continued to fundraise with online events and social media campaigns. For more information on the Ollie Lee Trust, or to support them, you can go to their website, which is theollieleetrust.org.
And now we hear from the local Muslim community as they detail the period of Ramadan through their Ramadan diaries. A time of reflection and heightened connection to faith during month of fasting. To mark Ramadan, which started on April the 13th and is the second under COVID restrictions, we asked St Albans Muslims to diarise their experiences. Here, Zahida Malik, 46, discusses the start of a month of fasting. Ramadan is a very important and spiritual time in the Islamic calendar, and during the month, Muslims don't eat or drink between dawn and sunset. Fasting is important to all Muslims as it allows them to devote themselves to their faith and come closer to God. Ramadan is also a time for spiritual reflection, prayer, doing good deeds, contributing money to charities to support those that have less or are in difficult times due to war, famine, etc. It is compulsory for all Muslims who can afford to contribute money to charity. And spending time with family and friends, although this year this will be through Zoom or WhatsApp. "I have been participating in Ramadan since the age of 9 and have always looked forward to it, as it is a very special month to me. The month of Ramadan means much more to me than not eating during daylight hours. Since getting older and wiser, I've found it is a time of reflection, self-improvement, and a heightened connection to one's faith. Islam is sadly something often misunderstood or simply ignored by much of the non-Muslim population. To catch a glimpse of my time during Ramadan, I have written a daily diary of events during this blessed month. Day 1. Tuesday, April 13th. Before going to bed on Monday evening after my first Taraweeh prayers, I set my alarm for 3 a.m. so I can get up for suhoor to eat. My alarm goes off at 3 a.m. and the last thing I want to do was get out of bed, as not only do I have to prepare food for me, but also for my two teenage daughters, who this year are also hoping to do all 30-day fasts. However, I don't have to worry about my husband, as he sorts himself out for food independently, which is such a help, as it's one less person to worry about feeding before suhoor ends and the fast starts. For breakfast, we had croissant, a bowl of strawberries, raspberries and blueberries with a drizzle of honey and natural Greek yogurt and toast, followed by a cup of tea for me and a glass of milk for my daughters. We also made sure we drank a good amount of water to help keep hydrated for the day. Then we brushed our teeth and we were back to bed by 4 a.m. to try and sleep again before waking up at 7 a.m. for work and getting my daughters to school. This first day of fasting was more tiring than feeling hungry due to the number of times I had to break my sleep to wake up to eat. I think I only got about 6 hours sleep. The day went quickly at work and it was soon time to collect my daughters from school. I hardly felt any pangs of hunger or thirst, although I did feel colder than my work colleagues due to not eating and fueling the body to keep warm. When we got home, we showered and prepared for prayer. I started to prepare food around 5 p.m. for iftar, breaking of fast, which was at 7:58 p.m. In between preparing food, I also try and take time to read some of the Quran. As fast time comes to an end, we all gather as a family by the table and share the food by firstly eating a date to break the fast. The taste and smell is more noticeable when fasting, as you've deprived yourself of food all day, and when you do get to eat it, you appreciate it more and are thankful for it. Materialistic things don't come to mind when fasting, as you only think about practical survival things like the basic human needs of food and water. Once I've eaten, I feel really full and sleepy, but can't rest as I need to clean up and get ready for evening prayers, which start around 9:50 p.m. Once prayers are complete at 10:30 p.m, I then get ready for bed and once again set my alarm for 3 a.m. Day 2. Wednesday, April the 14th. The alarm goes off at 3 a.m. and we had exactly the same breakfast, as it kept me, my daughters and husband full and hydrated for the day as best it could. Plus, it was too early and I was too tired to be creative in the kitchen at that time in the morning. The important thing is to make sure that we've eaten a well-balanced breakfast and had plenty of fluids, especially water. We don't take too long to eat, as all of us want to go back to sleep before waking up for work and school. I do my morning prayers, brush my teeth and return to bed and try and get some sleep. The alarm for work goes off at 7 a.m. and I feel really tired, as do my family, but push myself out of bed and get ready for work. My mind is a lot more alert as I try not to think about food, and so I put my full concentration into my work and find I'm more productive. When it hits 3 p.m, I collect my daughters from school and get home and repeat the process from Tuesday. Prayers, prepare food and break fast at dusk with dates and water before the main meal. The types of food prepared are very varied, such as opening the fast with a small bowl of fresh fruit, dates and water, and then a main meal consisting of either butter chicken, rice and naans, or spaghetti bolognese or finger food. Whatever the family feel like, I will prepare, so that when we're in the car driving home, my daughters usually let me know what they would like to eat, as does my husband. I'm feeling tired, and I really just want to crash, but I can't, as I need to get food ready as well as catch up on prayers and get ready for evening prayers too. Fast breaks, we eat, pray, and get to bed. Day 3, Thursday, April the 15th. The alarm goes off at 3 a.m., and we eat, pray, and go back to bed for a few hours before having to wake up for work. I am feeling very tired today, experiencing the pain of lack of sleep due to irregular sleeping patterns, but still find the spiritual strength to keep going. I know there are people out in the world who are less fortunate than myself and my family. I feel fasting keeps me grounded and real. The workday goes quickly, but during the last hour I'm feeling tired, trying to keep motivated and looking forward to getting home. This time, feeling tired, we all decide to have finger food, as I really want to get a short nap before fast breaks and evening prayers start. Day 4. Friday, April 16th. I can't believe it's Friday and the fourth day into my fasting. The week has gone very quickly. Today I am feeling a little lethargic due to lack of sleep, as still only getting 6 hours. For me, the hardest part of fasting is the sleep deprivation. I've got into the habit of fasting due to years of practice, so don't really feel the hunger as I've built up my resilience for this. But the lack of sleep during fasting does get to me at times, so I do take a nap once I get home at 4 p.m. and set my alarm for 5:30 p.m. to wake up and prepare food for iftar, which is now at 8 p.m. The fast break times change daily, so we have a daily calendar which our local mosque supplies to guide us as to when we can break our fast and when we can start the fast each morning. As it's Friday, I feel a little more relaxed as I know I don't have to wake up for work the next day as it's the weekend. Days 5 and 6, Saturday, April the 17th and Sunday, April the 18th. The weekend is a lot more chilled. We don't tend to do much socialising or go out. Due to COVID restrictions, I don't feel like I'm missing out on anything special. During fasting, we cut out the majority of socialising and instead focus more on prayers, family time and connecting with members of the community and friends we have not seen in ages. Generally, family and friends come over to break fast with us, but due to COVID, this has changed and now we get in touch via Zoom and other social media platforms. The weekend has also given me time to sort out where I would like to give my zakat, charity. This is a must for all Muslims who can afford to, as they give money to the less fortunate. My zakat has gone to the most needy in the countries where people have been affected by the aftermath of war and countries where there is a high rate of famine. It is also our duty to give charity money to Muslim families who are poor and can't afford a good meal, whether they're in the UK or overseas in another country. So food parcels are arranged for the full 30 days for poor families so they can have a joyful and spiritual Ramadan too. I will continue to note down my experiences over the rest of the month.
This article is under the news section, headed Giant Glass Wings Installed at St Albans Cathedral to Offer Solace. The unique installation has been handcrafted by leading glass artist Lane Roan, especially for St Albans Cathedral, using glass blowing and sculpting techniques. It was in response to the unfolding global COVID-19 situation that glass artist Lane was inspired to create the Solace Glass Wings installation, which will be on display in the north transept of St Albans Cathedral until Friday, May the 14th. Speaking of the symbolism of the installation, Lane said, "I have always had an affinity for flight and have produced several bodies of work based on this theme. This fascination led to making a small-scale set of angel wings, which represented freedom and fragility, but also power, strength and protection. I wanted the glass wings to be a symbol of unity, strength and a focus for people of all faiths and none to reflect on the past year. People have been coming to St Albans Cathedral seeking quiet reflection and relief for centuries, and the installation of these glass wings will bring a new way of helping visitors and pilgrims to remember loved ones and contemplate all that has happened over the past year. Designed as a reflective memorial to the pandemic, the installation is made up of 160 individually blown glass feathers. Each feather is then hung from the bones of the wings forged in iron by Ryan Harms. The installation is a first for the cathedral and is thought to be unique as a work. Sculptures of this size are traditionally made using sheets of glass rather than using the art of glass blowing." Canon Abby Thompson, acting dean of St Albans Cathedral, said, "St Albans Cathedral is full of light, candlelight flickering, coloured light through the stained glass windows and the changing light of every day. This installation will come to life, shining and catching the light in different ways, and I hope its beauty will help people to reflect on all the sorrows of the year that has passed and find hope. Admission to the cathedral is free and full COVID-19 safety precautions will be in place." And there's a picture of the giant glass wings in the abbey accompanying the article.
and now a story about a new wildflower book. In a bid to support local school children's environmental studies, pupils at an East Cambridgeshire primary school have been gifted a new wildflower book. Written by local author Molly Dyson and illustrated by Anne Biggs, Wayside Flowers of Haddenham was written in a bid to educate others. Ms. Biggs said, "During recent months, many of us have been walking our local footpaths and open spaces and seeing and enjoying new things in the natural world. Wayside Flowers of Haddenham focuses on what is growing in and around the village." Children at Robert Arkenstall Primary School were given copies of the book to support their environmental studies. Haddenham Conservation Society has funded production of the book, and copies, priced £3.50, can be obtained from Haddenham Arts Centre. Profits from the sale of the book will help further the work of the Conservation Society. And the article is accompanied by a lovely photo of six of the children from the primary school with copies of the book, accompanied by Molly herself and one of their teachers.
Litter pickers discover 7-centimetre knife in St Peter's churchyard. A 7-centimetre knife was discovered, discarded in undergrowth, by litter pickers clearing up a St Albans churchyard. St Albans litter picking community volunteers were working at St Peter's Church on Sunday afternoon as part of their regular rubbish clearance. Volunteer Irena Perkins found a knife, which had a 7-centimetre blade, a metal handle and no cover, in a bush in the graveyard at around 4 p.m. Group founder Stefania Vinci, who was also on the litter pick, explained, "We were clearing up the rubbish in the grassy area behind the church. The sort of things we were picking up were usually cans and bottles, so we're horrified to find a used condom, a huge knife and a syringe. We had a 9-year-old helping out, and it was very difficult to explain why they were there. I do this because I want to make St Albans a nicer place for everyone and wildlife. I lead by example, in the hope that others will join me. I was rather surprised. What the hell is a knife doing in here? And also the used condom. Why are people doing this? If my family were laid to rest in the graveyard, I would be even more upset by the disrespect shown to them. I'm so in love with nature, so imagine if a bird or squirrel got hold of the condom when you see what something as simple as a plastic can holder can do to a bird, strangle them to death." A St Albans District Council spokesman said, "Our contractor maintains the grounds and reports anything unusual to us, such as the discovery of a knife or evidence of rough sleeping. Our community protection team has dealt in the past with concerns about rough sleeping, drug use and street drinking in that area, although nothing recently. In tackling such issues when they arise, the team works closely with the police, other public agencies and charities. Both St Peter's Church and Hertfordshire Police have also been contacted for a comment."
Next, we have an article by Eric Roberts written for the St Albans Civic Society entitled "Opportunity Knocks for Drover's Way." It surely comes as no surprise that the British public overwhelmingly showed a preference for traditional architecture over brutalism in a recent poll conducted by the Policy Exchange. The survey of over 1,500 people found that the majority liked public buildings built in the 19th century style through to the early 20th century the best. Top of the poll came Bristol City Hall, built in 1952 to a Neo-Georgian style. Indeed, the top five were all built in a traditional design, while those at the bottom of the poll were all postmodern and brutalist, built after 1960, like the Town Hall in Hove from 1974. Many people appear uneasy when it comes to modern architecture. It need not be so, for when good Contemporary design is applied sympathetically to surroundings, like Art Deco was. The result can be uplifting. We can draw some similar comparisons right here in St Albans along St Peter's Street. Framed at the southern end is the former town hall, built in 1830 to a Neo-Grecian style by architect George Smith. Whilst we have seen the once brutal facade of the BHS building demolished, there are the somewhat block-like buildings opposite currently housing Barclays and a betting shop named Lockie and Forrester Houses, respectively, Gibbard, 1960. We wonder how people rate them. That BHS building has been replaced by a new hotel, Travel Lodge, which, with its more traditional brick facade and despite some controversial adornments, blends in much better with the street scene. Its entrance is in Drover's Way. There, an opportunity presents itself, but will it be missed? Drover's Way, until recently, presented a very off-putting look to anyone arriving into St Albans seeking this cathedral city's multi-storey car park. It gave a bad impression, and more like some armpit of St Albans welcome. But things have started to change for the better. Now there is the Premier Inn building's entrance, a modern block of flats on the former butler's site, and the new Travel Lodge entrance. The Market Stalls compound might be up for possible development. The former nightclub is to become residential, and there is the area at the rear of the empty Holland and Barrett and Pound Shop stores. This is a real opportunity to enhance the streetscape. It is to be hoped architects, developers, and the council's planners and councillors will take notice of the recent poll and the public's preference for well-designed, new buildings reflecting some traditional characteristics with an overall planning vision. Along with some pedestrian safety measures at certain pinch points, Drover's Way could become considerably enhanced, thus demonstrating the government's aim in its planning reforms to build beautiful, in keeping with local designs and people's preferences. Join us in looking out for the planning applications and exercising your right to comment, whilst you still can.
This piece is under the news section and it's headed Mumpreneurs Launch Reusable Colouring Sheets to Protect Environment. Are you worried about the amount of colouring books your children plough through on a weekly basis? Two local sisters might have the answer to your prayers. Nicole Broad, 37, and 34-year-old Laura Lester have launched Doodle You, a new company selling personalised reusable colouring sheets for children, which help the environment. The sisters have four daughters between them, Amelie, 10, 7-year-old Stevie, Olivia, 2, and Lily, who has just turned 1, and were determined to improve the sustainability of their colouring. Brickett Wood resident Laura had observed that Olivia's simple water-based colouring activity simply didn't keep her attention and was keen to find a solution that allowed the activity to be repeated and reinvented. I really appreciated the impact and enjoyment of a simple colouring in-book, but I was so unimpressed with the wastage, not just paper but money spent on pencils, pens and erasers. How can a 2-year-old go through so much? Then there's the mess. Most parents are forever tidying up. Nicole was immediately on board, having a daughter with dyslexia who struggles with mainstream learning, but has found colouring to be a form of art therapy, helping her to relax and to relieve her anxiety. Nicole, who lives in Radlett, explained, "We are both family orientated and passionate about creating engaging products to aid children's development and imagination. After becoming concerned about the number of hours our children were spending on screens during lockdown, we dreamed up the idea for Doodle You." She added, "Colouring is known to have the ability to relax the fear centre of your brain. It induces the same state as meditation by reducing the thoughts of a restless mind." Doodle You launches new themes every few weeks, including Dinosaurs, Let There Be Love, and the Over the Rainbow theme, of which 10% of sales will be given to Fight for Life, an NHS charity dedicated to raising funds for children with cancer. Youngsters use washable markers on the specialised paper, which can then be wiped clean and used time and time again. Every order is personalised and delicately incorporated into the design of each theme. Nicole added, "Starting a new venture during the most unpredictable year in living memory would be daunting for some. Not for us. We are driven to bring Doodle U to as many children as possible, to develop more products which help kids to play, learn and focus, and to make parents' lives easier too."
Residential care charity set to close due to pandemic pressures. A 60-year-old residential care charity serving the elderly and vulnerable of St Albans faces the axe due to financial pressures brought on by the pandemic. The Abbeyfield St Albans Society, which marked its diamond anniversary in 2020, operates out of Grace Muriel House in Tavistock Avenue, where it provides both long stay and respite care. But the Board of Trustees has this week announced the proposed closure of Grace Muriel House at the end of June. Chairman George Ashworth said the decision was made with profound sadness and regret. He explained, "We are sensitive to both the legal and moral obligations we have to our residents, staff and other stakeholders. In particular, the impact that this decision will have on our residents, whose well-being remains our top priority. We will now work with residents, their loved ones and the relevant authorities to find suitable new homes which meet their individual needs. The board is unanimous in its desire to oversee a professional, orderly and above all compassionate process, something which would not be possible if this decision were to be delayed." He revealed that the team at Grace Muriel House has been challenged considerably and consistently over the last 12 months. The charity, which enjoys an outstanding rating from the Care Quality Commission, has been operating at well below economic levels of capacity for almost a year, following the deaths of several residents and a trustee in April. As a result, it has been using its limited cash reserves to not only maintain day-to-day care operations, but also maintaining the infrastructure of a building which is demanding increasing and more frequent expenditure. Mr. Ashworth explained, "The financial straw which broke the camel's back came recently in the form of a fire safety inspection report. This pointed out serious deficiencies in the area of the roof void. The cost of the work is considerable, and this, combined with the aggregate financial impact of the pandemic, far exceeds the financial wherewithal of the charity to remain financially viable in the short term." Mr. Ashworth said he had no doubt the closure of Grace Muriel House will be a sad day for many in St Albans and beyond connected with the charity. "I am incredibly proud of and grateful to all the team at Grace Muriel House for all they have accomplished, particularly over the last 12 months. The next few weeks will be incredibly difficult, and so to all involved with the charity and to all our stakeholders who have supported us so well in the past, I wish to offer you a heartfelt thank you. Staff at the home are hoping for an 11th hour reprieve to keep it open." Grace Muriel team leader Louise Giles said, "The home has been hit hard by COVID and due to low number of residents, it's losing a lot of money every month. The residents range up to 103 years old and many of the staff have devoted their lives to the home, many having been here for over 20 years. It is an outstanding home and we are all devastated by the news of its closure. Unfortunately, at this stage, we think it's too late for any fundraising. But if the local community know about it, you never know what might happen. The origins of the house date back to 1960, when a group of individuals came together for a sherry party in the Mayor's Parlour with Sir Victor Goodhue, the then MP for St Albans, leading the discussion of an establishment of a home for older people in the city. Two serving aldermen, Frank Lavery and Harold Child, joined Sir Victor in forming the Abbeyfield St Albans Society. The current Board of Trustees is drawn from the local community and provide their professional expertise and experience on a voluntary basis to support, to help and guide the dedicated, caring and professional team of some 60 staff to operate Grace Muriel House.
This next item is provided by the charity Rennie Grove Hospice Care and is entitled Behind the Scenes, A Nurse's Insight. During the pandemic, Rennie Grove's 24-hour responsive nursing care in patients' homes has been in higher demand than ever. The charity's nurses have been able to keep visiting patients at home throughout, helping to prevent hospital admissions and keeping local families affected by life-limiting illness safe and together in their own homes. Recent recruit Emma, who joined Rennie Grove 6 months ago after a 20-year career as a community nurse, gives an insight into the role of a hospice at home nurse with the charity and why she chose it. With Rennie Grove, I'm able to build on my nursing knowledge and specialise in palliative care, explains Emma. I can work holistically with patients, addressing all aspects of their care. We also advocate for patients, liaising with other healthcare professionals so care is fully joined up and families have more quality time to spend together. I have time to listen and to give patients and their families the time and space to talk as and when they need to. We also liaise with patients' GPs on their behalf regarding symptoms, medication, suggested next steps. I think this is so valuable, especially right now, when doctors' surgeries are so busy. Palliative care, especially in the community, involves anticipating and planning for the next stage in a patient's illness. Patients can suddenly deteriorate, and as a hospice at home nurse, Emma says you need to be able to think on your feet, responding quickly and sensitively. Working in a team at Rennie Grove gives me the confidence to put the planning I've done into practice at short notice, she adds. It's always a privilege to be welcomed into a patient's home to provide care, and as a nurse with Rennie Grove, I've got the opportunity and resources to work entirely holistically. It's taken my practice to a deeper level and given me the confidence to push myself to make a difference and make every moment matter. If you or someone you know could make a difference in this way too, please join the team at Rennie Grove. And to find out more, you can visit their website, which is renniegrove.org/jobs.
Life-changing and life-enhancing. Impact of Duke of Edinburgh Award. A young woman from St Albans has paid tribute to the life-changing impact of her Duke of Edinburgh Award in the wake of the funeral of Prince Philip. Maya Richards, 21, who has cerebral palsy and spastic diplegia, said that achieving a Bronze Award 3 years ago helped break down the barriers of perception around her disability and gave her the confidence to enrol on a college course. Maya, who also has Tourette's syndrome and visual impairment, meaning she has no peripheral vision, completed her Bronze DfE programme whilst at Lonsdale School in Stevenage. She said, "Because of the Duke of Edinburgh's award, I'm now on a mainstream college course studying health and social care, and that's all down to the DfE. It's built up my confidence. Before that, I was doing special needs courses, so it's been life-changing and life-enhancing." It gives you the ability rather than looking at disability all the time and helps you see what your capabilities are and what you can achieve in the future. You realise you're an equal and it builds up your confidence to say to people, "I'm disabled, but I can do this." Maya explained why she decided to complete her Bronze DfE. "I just thought I would join in and see how far I would get with it, and I went on to finish it. It made me feel on the same level as everyone else taking part. It was challenging, but at the same time, I really enjoyed it. Our school had varying levels of disability, so it was great to mix with people without disabilities. I'm now doing my silver programme and I'm mixing with people who have the same interest as me, and I'm building up my mainstream social skills too. I think the experiences have a life-changing effect, especially for people who are more disabled by society rather than their actual disability and are not encouraged. I was encouraged all the time. To complete the expedition held locally in Stevenage, Maya received support from Lonsdale School carers who assisted her throughout the day, with a highlight being cooking around the campfire. Reflecting on Prince Philip's legacy, Maya said, "I'm really glad the Duke of Edinburgh started the D of E Award and that my school enabled me to take part, because without it I might have left school without a career plan." When you're disabled, you think, what's the point in trying to qualify when society views disability so negatively? But if you don't try, you don't know. Maya is now studying health and social care at Oaklands College in Welwyn Garden City, with the aim to work at providing end-of-life care for children. She said, "I have chosen to go into this field for my future career because I have had lots of friends with Duchenne muscular dystrophy, and I would like to be able to provide a better quality of life for people suffering from this condition and other life-limiting conditions in childhood." Since 2013, a total of 41,342 young people have enrolled in the Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme through Hearts County Council, with 19,072 achieving awards so far across the three levels – bronze, silver and gold, through volunteering, physical activity, learning new skills, expeditions and residentials at gold level only. Participants have until they are age 25 to complete the awards. Jenny Coles, Director of Children's Services, said, "The Duke of Edinburgh's award has been a part of the County Council's contribution to enhancing the lives and life chances of our young people since the early 1970s. This fantastic legacy from the Duke of Edinburgh will continue to offer life-changing and inclusive opportunities to young people from diverse backgrounds, equipping them with independence, essential life skills, camaraderie, and a chance to contribute to their communities." And this article is accompanied by a picture of Maya attempting to erect a tent, and it looks like she's having a lot of fun in the process.
Former Hearts Ads reporter's charming new picture book. A former Hearts advertiser reporter will achieve his long-held dream next week when his first children's book is published. Albert Upside Down, written by ex-Hearts Ad journalist Ian Brown and illustrated by Ian Clark, is available from April the 27th. The picture book is packed with charming illustrations and perfect for inquisitive, playful little minds. Published by Graphegg, it is the first in a heartwarming new series from the award-winning duo of TV writer Ian Brown and animation director Ian Clark. It's taken years to secure a deal, and at last the first in a series of picture books is coming out, said Ian, who had joined Hearts Ad as a junior reporter after NCTJ training at the then Harlow Technical College in 1984. In the 1980s, Ian covered court golden and diamond weddings, the Hearts County Show, crime, and was later the dedicated reporter for the Hearts Ad's Radlett and Boreham Wood edition, covering Radlett, Boreham Wood, Elstree and Shenley. He then became a sub-editor on the paper before leaving after 5 years, going on to work for national newspapers, London evening papers and then TV, including Top Gear and The South Bank Show. Over an illustrious 30-year career in television, Ian has written for the best in the business, from Homer Simpson to Bruce Forsyth, Simon Cowell to Harrison Ford, from This Is Your Life to Comic Relief, Strictly Come Dancing and BBC Maestro, and now introducing the biggest star yet, Albert the Tortoise. Inspired by the adventures of real-life Greek tortoise Albert, who was rescued more than 50 years ago and has lived happily with Ian's family ever since, this is a timeless tale that uses humour to show children the power of working together and thinking creatively. Currently, there are set to be 4 books in the Albert series, aimed at 3-plus-year-olds and tortoise fans of all ages, with more to follow.
The books were ideas I kept trying to get published on and off over many years, said Ian. There were lots of rejections from agents and publishers. And he continued, the book touches on the importance of teamwork, perseverance, building resilience. And ever more timely as 2020 and 2021 revealed themselves, despite being written long before the importance of helping others literally get back on their feet. In the charming picture book, Albert has a problem trying to reach a tasty treat. He has ended up on his shell, upside down and stuck. Can the other garden creatures overcome their rivalry, team up and help him get back on his feet? Vibrantly illustrated by animation director Ian Clark, part of the animation team behind CBBC's Operation Ouch and ITV's You've Been Framed, Albert and his garden friends are set to capture the hearts of children everywhere. Albert Upside Down also includes fascinating facts about these modern-day mini dinosaurs living life on the veg. Did you know that tortoises are among the most ancient creatures on Earth? Or that they live on every continent except Antarctica? The second adventure featuring Albert and his garden friends, Albert and the Wind, will be published in October 2021. Celebrities have already praised the illustrated adventures of Albert. The Fast Show's Paul Whitehouse said, it's utterly brilliant and charming, and if you're an upside-down tortoise, it's essential reading. Countryfile presenter John Craven wrote, what a treat for our youngest book lovers and for grown-ups who will guide them through it. Stunning illustrations and well-chosen words tell the story of Albert and the tortoise getting back on his feet after a fall, helped by a somewhat disorganised band of garden creatures. YouTube star Joe Sugg, who appeared on Strictly Come Dancing, described it as a great little story of coming together to help those in need and fantastically illustrated. Former Top Gear presenter Jeremy Clarkson added, I like this book. I like the drawings and I like the man who wrote it. I like tortoises. What's not to like? Get to know the real Albert better on Twitter or Facebook. And the book itself can be ordered from all local bookshops, Amazon and on the World Wide Web.
This piece is under Things to Do. An aspiring playwright from St Albans has won a scriptwriting competition, and his play will be available for schools to perform later this year. The Young People's Puppet Theatre, YPPT, ran a competition during the first lockdown to find new scripts for their library. Budding Beaumont school playwright Oliver McKinnon entered his idea along with a draft of Scene 1 and was chosen as a winner. The prize was to work with a mentor from the YPPT to work the idea up into a full script. Oliver previously took part in a YPPT production in 2017 when Beaumont School performed in the International Organ Festival, staging A Midsummer Night's Dream at the Maltings Theatre in St Albans. He is thrilled to have now produced an original script for them. Oliver said, as an aspiring writer and a YPPT alumni, I did A Midsummer Night's Dream in 2017. When I saw the competition at the beginning of the first lockdown, I thought it would be a great experience and a fun way to fill my time. He was mentored by Jeremy Duchesne, the executive director, from late September last year and finished the script earlier this year. The play called Robbing a Bank, a How Not To Guide, is a comedy about two friends who decide to rob a bank because they're fed up with not having enough money to buy ice cream. However, it all goes wrong with people disguising themselves as members of the gang, the wrong people getting caught, and of course, there's ice cream. I got the idea for this play whilst I was walking my dog, which is where I get the ideas for most of the stories I come up with, said Oliver. The script will be offered to schools from September 2021, and Oliver is hoping he will be able to go and watch the production when it is ready. The Year 11 Beaumont pupil said, working with a mentor to develop my ideas into a full script was really helpful, and I can't wait to write more in the future. I am looking forward to seeing the play put on by a school soon.
St Albans MP Daisy Cooper looks back on a week in Westminster, and her focus is on university students. Time to compensate uni students for a lost year of education. University students have had a really raw deal over the past year, and many young people and their parents have contacted me about it. Last autumn, students were encouraged to travel to university, despite warnings from the sector that it could cause a public health crisis. Vast numbers of students soon found themselves having to self-isolate in their digs, with some waking up to find security barriers around their halls of residence. Online learning was necessary, but meant students had no access to libraries, labs, or face-to-face teaching. Students were told they couldn't go home for Christmas, and then they were told they could. And then, after Christmas, they were told they couldn't return to university again. When the roadmap out of lockdown for England was revealed, it didn't include a return date for students, even though the one for Wales did. This week, a return date was eventually revealed, 17th of May. But for many students, this comes after their courses have already finished. After a year of confusion, disruption, and uncertainty for students, this really was the final end-of-term insult. As well as not being able to enjoy the typical university experience, students have also suffered financially. They've had months of paying for accommodation they couldn't use, months of paying full-rate fees for online learning, and months without being able to work. Many students have fallen behind on rent and bills, and some are even needing to use food banks. It's no surprise that more than 50% of students say their mental health has got worse. In many cases, universities have tried really hard. They adapted to online teaching as quickly as possible and invested a lot of money to do so. But universities themselves are in a financially precarious position and cannot be expected to compensate students alone. I secured an urgent question in Parliament to challenge the university's minister. I urged her to carry out a rapid review on how to compensate university students for lost learning and finances, and asked her to reconsider cross-party calls to double the funds available to students facing financial hardship, in line with the Welsh Government. With pupils back at school and college, outdoor pubs and non-essential shops now open, and the government scientists saying that a managed return of university students wouldn't pose any extra risk, it's not hard to see why so many students feel forgotten.
Homegrown talent will be showcased by Harpenden Community Music Festival, set to go ahead after lockdown eases. The Festival on the Field, held at St John Law's School playing field on Saturday, July the 3rd, features the likes of renowned mass karaoke band Masaoki, Madness tribute act One Step Behind, and 24K Bruno, a Bruno Mars tribute, complete with professional dancers. Festival Chairman Mark Hill said, "In addition to this array of talent, we are delighted to be showcasing some phenomenal local performers." Opening the festival this year will be up-and-coming indie rock band Stratton 5, who have garnered plenty of attention elsewhere, having been played on numerous local and international radio stations. Popular Harpen-based covers group The Up and Overs are also part of the lineup. The band has been together in various guises for over 25 years, having met playing rugby at Harpenden. They play a diverse mix of covers from the last 6 decades. Mark added, "The festival is very excited to announce that Harpenden born and bred Emma McGrath will also be playing this year. Emma first gained attention when she won the inaugural PRS Lindsay DePaul Prize for songwriting at the age of 15. The Silent Minds EP followed in 2018, and lead single Love You Better, co-written with Jimmy Hogarth, featured on Spotify's New Music Friday US playlist and has achieved over 2 million streams up to date. Her follow-up EP, Keep Your Eyes Open, was released in early 2020 to similar acclaim, achieving 13 Spotify New Music Friday playlists around the world. Who knew that Harpenden had such a wealth of talent, added Mark. As usual, there will be a full fairground and a wide choice of refreshments on offer at this year's event. There'll also be the opportunity to watch the Euros, should England be playing that day. Festival on the Field, which raises money for two Harpenden schools, will be held on the St John Laws School playing field in Manland Way, Harpenden. And the article is accompanied by a lovely photo of the Festival in the Field back in 2018. A beautiful sunny day, lots of people enjoying themselves to the music.
Now for a look at some of this coming week's radio highlights. Starting with Saturday, April 24th. The drama on Radio 4 at 2:45 is The Voyage of St. Louis, telling the true story of the ocean liner which left Germany with more than 900 Jewish refugees on board, all hoping to escape persecution. On Classic FM at 4 p.m, as usual, Moira Stewart's Hall of Fame concert includes works played in full, featuring Prokofiev, Beethoven, Shostakovich, Morricone, Stuart Mitchell, Gershwin and Copland. At the same time on Radio 4 Extra at 4 p.m, there's a Miss Marple murder mystery starring June Whitfield in The Moving Finger, first broadcast in 2001. And back to Radio 4 at 10:15 p.m, the subject of The Reunion is the Litvinenko poisoning. We talked about this last week, recalling his poisoning and death in London in 2006, which led to a breakdown of relations between Britain and Russia. Sunday, April 25th, for early birds at 6:35 a.m. on Radio 4, the Radio Times choice is On Your Farm, in which Verity Sharp takes on the challenge of running a farm in Pembrokeshire, despite limited experience. Staying with Radio 4 at 11:45 a.m, Just One Thing with Michael Mosley, in his guide to surprisingly simple ways to boost health and well-being. In this, the fourth in the series, Michael looks at learning a new skill. Followed just after midday on Radio 4 by Just a Minute, when Tom Allen's guests are Josie Lawrence, Mark Watson, Paul Merton and Felicity Ward. Turning to Radio 3, two programmes look at two very different instruments. At 5 p.m. in The Listening Service, the subject is the bagpipes, followed by Words and Music at 5:30, featuring the trumpet. Still on Radio 3 to finish at 11:30 p.m, Slow Radio, which journeys into the heart of the Cairngorms, looking in the footsteps of writer and poet Nan Shepherd. The programme captures the sounds of the places she writes about with readings from her work, The Living Mountain. On to those programmes, which are broadcast at the same time every day from Monday to Friday. Same radio station, same time, every weekday. At 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 and repeated at 12:30 each day, Book of the Week continues the story of the great post office trial. The 15-minute drama at 10:45 on Radio 4 is a continuation from last week of Amongst Women by John McGarren. On Radio 3 at 12 noon this week, Composer of the Week is Eric Satie. At just after midday on Radio 4 and repeated at 10:45 all week, Monday to Friday, Beth O'Leary's light-hearted story, The Flatshare, continues, about underpaid publicity agent Tiffy, who finds an unusual solution to her housing crisis. 1:45 p.m, Monday to Friday, Radio 4, the series 39 Ways to Save the Planet, continues to look at its eco-friendly projects. And at 1:30 or at 8:30 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra, to mark the 100th anniversary of his birth, you can hear Peter Ustinov reading from his autobiography, Dear Me, recorded in 1978. Back to those individual programmes for the rest of the week, though, with Monday, April 26th on the agenda. Radio 4 at 11 a.m. in the series The Untold. The new build is the Radio Times choice and follows a story of a couple anxiously hoping to buy their own home. The drama on Radio 4 at 2 p.m. is Suffer Little Children, translated from a radio play by Austrian writer Gabrielle Kogel. On her 80th birthday, a woman recounts a life of sacrifice and weighs up its value. Still on Radio 4 at 8 p.m, the past returns to Gdansk. Journalist Michael Segeloff traces the story of his Jewish grandfather, Oscar, who fled Gdansk in 1937 with his family to escape the growing Nazi threat. More than 80 years later, Oscar died a proud British citizen, and now Michael heads to Gdansk to investigate his family's past. And on Radio 3 at 10:45 to finish Monday, New Generation Thinkers brings us the story of Francis Buckley, who used his training for military intelligence to shape how he set about digging up and recording objects buried both in First World War battlefields of France and then in his archaeological work on the Yorkshire Moors. Tuesday, April 27th, 11 a.m, Radio 4, the first in a new series, Dare to Repair, is called How We Broke the Future, and looks at why the UK is guilty of throwing away so much technology. 11:30, also on Radio 4, part 3 of Britain in 10 Operas, called Football and Fishermen. The programme looks at the 1990s, when else, the Italia 90 World Cup and the three tenors took the sounds of classical opera into a popular mainstream. To Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 for the Luddite Lament, folk singer John Tams examines the story of the Luddites through songs they sang about their machine-breaking exploits, hardship, and their hero, General Ludd. To Radio 4 at 3:30 for Shipping, this week's edition of Costing the Earth. When a cargo ship blocked the Suez Canal for nearly a week in March, the eyes of the world focused on shipping. Hundreds of vessels were stuck at the entrance to one of the world's busiest trade routes. So what effect does the quantity of goods being moved around the globe have on the environment? 6:30, Radio 4 Extra, Soul Music, in which soprano Leslie Garrett and star yachtsman Jeff Holt reflect on the impact of the song The Impossible Dream for the 1965 musical Man of La Mancha. And on Radio 3 in concert at 7:30, to finish Tuesday, Simon Rattle conducts 40 members of the London Symphony Orchestra and 30 freelance extras in a special strings concert of works by Grieg, Puccini, Barber, Herman and Vaughan Williams. Wednesday, April 28th, 9 a.m, Radio 4, in Life Changing, we hear the story of Charlie Wilson, a married father of two from Aberdeen in 2008, when he was 44, suffered a massive stroke and woke up with no memory of who he was. The programme hears how over the past 12 years, Charlie has learned techniques to help him recall what he's been told about his earlier life and keep hold of the new memories he's making with his family. On Radio 4 Extra at 11 a.m, there's a second chance to hear the inimitable P.G. Woodhouse, a celebration introduced by Alexander Armstrong. Woodhouse's characters are brought to life by Simon Cadell, Michael Horndon and Richard Briers, and there are interviews and archive recordings along with input from fans, friends and family. Back to Radio 4 at 11:30 for Keep Carmen Carry On, stand-up comedy in which Susan Carmen throws herself into various leisure pursuits. This week, birdwatching. Radio 4 Extra at 2:30, the Radio Times choice is Secret Catacombs of Paris, a programme from 2012 in which Jonathan Glancy explores the maze of underground tunnels in Paris. And at 3:30 on Radio 3, Choral Evensong was recorded last week at St Peter's Eaton Square in London. Thursday, April 29th, and the afternoon concert on Radio 3 at 2 p.m. is a performance of Beethoven's opera Fidelio, recorded on March 1st, 2020, at the Perth Festival in Western Australia. Followed at 3 p.m, this time on Radio 4, by Tales from the Black Mountains, in which travel writer Antonio Bolingbroke Kent describes how she moved to a cottage in the Welsh Black Mountains in October last year, arriving just 2 hours before lockdown began. She hears stories from neighbours who know every crease of the hills, every bird call, as well as the locals' history, myths and legends. The process whereby the unknown becomes known and becomes home. Meanwhile, on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m, there's the first of two parts of Thackeray's novel Barry Lyndon, in which a dual forces of 18th century Irish adventurer to leave home and serve in the Seven Years' War. Finally, Friday, April 30th, end of another week and the end of another month. An edition of the music quiz Counterpoint from 2010 can be heard on Radio 4 Extra at 9 and repeated at 4 p.m. Gardener's Question Time is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. 5 p.m. Radio 4 Extra is the first part of The Break, a comedy set in a fictional Yorkshire coastal town. Burnt out London boy Andy heads to his uncle's seaside home in search of a stress-free life. And to end the week, Any Questions on Radio 4 at 8 p.m. looks ahead to the elections, which take place across the country next week in the UK, with a panel of four prominent figures taking questions from listeners. That's it for this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable one of radio listening.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Highlights of a locked down year. A year of being forced to concentrate almost entirely on the wildlife on my doorstep has taken its toll on me, but in a good way, I believe. Spending protracted periods of time before breakfast, during lunch, or at the end of the day just sitting in the garden to see what happens is now part and parcel of my week. Sometimes not much happens. Sometimes the same thing as yesterday happens, but every now and then something extraordinary happens, and never does nothing happen. Just the other day, as I sat sipping tea outside, a bird came over the fence to my left, tore past my head and dived over the next fence, continuing on over the neighbouring gardens. In what has become a reflex action, I got my binoculars to my eyes just before it vanished, revealing it not to be the wood pigeon I had thought, but a woodcock, a first for my garden and totally unexpected. Another quirky habit I've developed over the last year is to sit out in the garden after dark and listen, maybe for a couple of hours before bed. As a result, I've learned quite a few things. One is simply that we, as humans, make an incredible amount of noise, and that noise is of a very dominating quality. Unlike the broken stanzas of a robin's song, or the many different calls of birds as they fly around, our noise, mostly cars and trains, tends to be continuous and unbroken. It leaves me wondering how this affects wildlife that would normally be able to listen without the background roar. I've also learned that another world awakes as ours goes to sleep. Birds that would never be seen or heard over the garden during the daylight hours take their chances at night. Moorhens and coots from the nearby golf course lake take up nightly patrol flights, their plaintive and repetitive calls tracking their circuits. This last weekend I heard the strangled squeal of their cousin, the water rail, accompanied by a moorhen as they flew, presumably quite close together, overhead. It is a world I cannot see, but at times can be quite busy. Of course, there are plenty of unidentified squeaks and calls, and maybe in time I will learn what those are. But for now, just simply recognising a bird call in the dark is exciting. Without the benefit of sight, the calls are always unexpected, and sometimes so loud they make you jump. One such bird recently was a flyover oyster catcher heading over the garden, and its loud pleep calls were subsequently heard by a friend further north in St Albans. This unseen world has prompted me to invest in a recording device, so that I can review the night sounds the next day using audio software on my computer. It has been fascinating to see the calls of various birds, not to mention police sirens and car horns, translated onto a spectrogram in full colour. The highest frequencies are the domain of our local pipistrel bats, creating sharp little spikes on the graph, while migrating redwings' thin seep calls appear as bolder vertical streaks further down the frequency range. I take great delight in the fact that, though I cannot see them, the birds and bats are there, and visible on the spectrograms with their own unique spectrum of frequencies. For me, the spectrograms provide a fitting picture for the past year, for although we have not been physically in the dark, we have nonetheless been greatly limited, unable to go and see the wider world we're used to. Instead, our graph has been coloured by the activities of our local wildlife, the rhythms of nature on our doorstep, and the comings and goings of all its inhabitants. The joy of these local discoveries have provided little spikes of colour and life, as bold and bright as any spectrogram, and given vital windows out to the wider world. As this spring brings hope of renewed freedoms, for me the call of the oyster catcher over the garden in the dark and the brief explosion of a woodcock over the fences will stay with me as treasured moments wherever I go.
Hello, I'm going to read an article from the latest edition of Heart's Life, and it's called The Roots of Revolution. And it says that 75 years on from its publication, we look at how George Orwell's time in rural Hertfordshire inspired perhaps his most famous book, Animal Farm. And it was written by Anne Cronbergs. The little village of Wallington in North Hertfordshire appears on a first visit to have remained relatively untouched by time in the 85 years since George Orwell lived here. It was here he found inspiration for many of the settings and characters in his iconic novel, Animal Farm, first published in 1945. A little sign saying Manor Farm can be seen on the roadside wall of the Great Barn, a large black timber-framed structure almost visible from the cottage on Kitts Lane, where Orwell, real name Eric Blair, lived between 1936 and 1940 with his wife Eileen. The writer probably had the lofty interior of the barn in mind for the scene in the novel, where Old Major, the prize middle white boar, shares his vision of animalism with the assembled creatures, encouraging them to believe in a new order in which humans are overthrown and animals enjoy the fruits of their own labour. Orwell's letters and diaries of the period show his close engagement with the politics of the era and his criticism of the rise of Stalinism, but also, and less well known, his hands-on experience as a smallholder, which enabled him to represent farming and farm animals with such authenticity. Orwell had the image of a pig in mind when he first made mention of Wallington, the village and animal farm is Willingdon, in a letter to a friend in February 1936. "I'm arranging to take a cottage at Wallington, near Baldock, in Hearts. Rather a pig in a poke because I've never seen it. It's very cheap, only 7 shillings and 6 pence a week." Situated at the heart of the village, the Stores was a primitive two-up, two-down with a corrugated metal roof and outside WC. It is opposite a piece of ground known as Kit's Peace, suitable grazing land for goats. By the time he moved there in April 1936, Orwell was planning to marry Eileen O'Shaughnessy, a postgraduate student he had met a year earlier at a party in London. On June the 9th, their wedding took place in the parish church of St. Mary's. Eva Wilson, a local villager, reported that the occasion was very simple. "Eileen and he walked down the road from the cottage together. George vaulted over the churchyard wall so as to be standing inside the gate to pick up Eileen and carry her to the church door, having plainly got his folklore muddled." In the months and years that followed, the couple established a working partnership deeply rooted in a country way of life, although one which ran in parallel to Orwell's ambitious program of writing and journalism. He penned Shooting an Elephant and The Road to Wigan Pier here, even involving them both in active military service during 1937 in the Spanish Civil War. He returned to Wallington to draft Homage to Catalonia. When at home, they shared in the running of a village shop from their front room, selling local produce and sweets in order to pay the rent. They kept chickens and grew crops in the back garden, in time acquiring two goats named Muriel and Kate, which grazed on Kit's Peace. At intervals, Orwell, and occasionally Eileen, maintained a smallholder's diary. "Muriel seems well, rather thin, appetite good. Still giving over 1.5 pints, close on a year in milk now. Yesterday planted a dozen carnations. Many apples forming. Strawberries should be netted about a fortnight from now." That's dated 26th of May, 1939. The diary shows Orwell's engagement in rearing livestock and cultivating crops all year round. From this way of life sprang the idea for Animal Farm, although by the time he actually began work on the novel, in November 1943, he and Eileen had taken a flat in central London, subletting the Wallington cottage to friends. At first, Orwell set out to write an explicit criticism of Stalin and totalitarianism. But according to Sylvia Topp, whose 2020 biography of Orwell reveals Eileen's crucial role in the crafting of Animal Farm, it was she who suggested writing the story as an allegory when the issue of Stalin as an ally made it difficult for his publisher in the original format. Orwell explained in a letter that his novel was about a farm run by people where the animals take over and make just as bad a job of it. Subtitled A Fairy Story, the work fuses political satire with the anthropomorphic characterization seen in Aesop's fables and the tales of Beatrix Potter, especially the tale of Pigling Bland. In a later preface to the novel, he recalled the precise moment years earlier in Wallington that had inspired him to write the story. He said, "I saw a little boy driving a huge cart horse along a narrow path, whipping it whenever it tried to turn. It struck me that if only such animals became aware of their own strength, we should have no power over them." For the fictional world of Manor Farm, Orwell certainly drew on his knowledge of Wallington and the surrounding area. The neighbouring Foxwood Farm derived from Quickswood, a local farm surrounded by woodland. The knoll where the animals gather is suggestive of the Whip, the field behind the old school. Muriel the Goat is a sympathetic portrayal of her real-life counterpart, whilst in Boxer, the stalwart old cart horse and the tragic hero of the novel, Orwell may have memorialised his Wallington neighbour, Fred Hatchett, Old H, who used to carry out heavy work for him in the garden. Fred was known for the way he walked on his heels, with the hobnails on his boots making a ringing sound like shire horses' hooves. Eileen is known to have had editorial input in the manuscript, and a particularly poignant example of this is perhaps Boxer's death scene. A thin stream of blood had trickled out of his mouth. "It's my lung," said Boxer in a weak voice. Orwell himself suffered from tubercular lesions on his lungs, which, while in Wallington in August 1938, had led him to hemorrhage very seriously. Animal Farm was considered too hot to handle by several major publishers, and after a series of rejection letters, Orwell considered publishing himself. However, Fred Warburg of Secker & Warburg eventually agreed to take it on. When, after its publication on August 17, 1945, several friends of Eileen read the novel, they sensed her light touch and humorous intelligence. Sadly, she herself died undergoing an operation in March 1945, while Orwell was abroad working as a war correspondent for The Observer. Orwell told a friend, "It was a terrible shame that Eileen didn't live to see the publication of Animal Farm, which she was particularly fond of and even helped in the planning of." The first print run of 4,500 copies sold out quickly, and a further run of 10,000 copies appeared in November. Subsequently translated into more than 70 languages, it has never been out of print. From the little fields of Wallington to the world, it is arguably the most effective critique of totalitarianism ever published.
Hello, my name's Sue, and this story is from Hertfordshire Life. It's called Heart's Heroines, and the words are by Caroline Thane. To celebrate Women's History Month, we dive into the past to celebrate 10 Hearts Wonder Women, who were pioneers and game changers. From intrepid adventuring to fighting for equality and helping to change society, they deserve their place in the Hearts Hall of Fame. Dolly Shepherd. Before TV, and long before the internet, entertainment was experienced live. Crowds would flock to the village fair and watch performers such as Edwardian parachutist Dolly Shepherd jump into thin air. Born in 1886 in Potter's Bar, she made a name for herself performing the first mid-air parachute jumps and extraordinarily saved another parachutist's life after their chute malfunctioned, but broke her back in the heroic act. Paralysed from the accident, Dolly made it into the Guinness Book of Records after she not only learned to walk again, against all the odds, but made it back up into the air soon after. Penny Hodges. A British engineer who worked on guided missile technology, Penny Hodges was awarded an OBE in 1972 for her contribution to the industry. Involved in the main professional bodies as one of the leading ladies of early science, technology, engineering and maths, STEM, she was also a member of Soroptimist International St Albans and District, part of a women's voluntary organisation to improve the lives of women and girls around the world, where she spent time and energy encouraging girls to take up engineering. Penny also won an award for her outstanding achievement in aviation, which was given to her by Prince Charles, and she featured in a TV documentary entitled Women in a Man's World. While one would hope that programme title is now outdated, women are still massively underrepresented in the STEM industries, with the female workforce making up just 13%. There's some way to go to continue Penny's work. Emily Davis. Emily Davis, 1830 to 1921, was a feminist, suffragette, and pioneering campaigner for women's access to university. She's mostly remembered for co-founding Girton College, the first university college in England for women. The college was originally located in Hitchin, but moved in 1873 to Cambridge. She strongly advocated an equal curriculum and quality of education for women as for men. Her tenacity was recognised with an honorary doctorate of law from the University of Glasgow in 1901. As a suffragist, Emily headed a delegation to Parliament and is known for opposing the militant methods of the suffragette movement. Margaret and Annie Johnson. Sisters Margaret and Annie Johnson were not just doing it for themselves, but arguably for women everywhere. As the first female police officers in Hertfordshire, the pair signed up in 1928. Based at a station in Ware, they moved around Hertfordshire wherever they were especially needed. In a male-dominated work environment, a lot of their work related to safeguarding women and children. Yet despite their much-needed skills, they didn't receive equal pay with their male counterparts for a staggering 45 years. They inspired more women to sign up to the constabulary, which in turn led to the numbers seen today. Now, approximately a third of Hearts Police are women, and there is almost no gender gap between the pay across staff. Still work to do, Margaret and Annie would no doubt say. Dame Ellen Terry. One of the most famous leading ladies of the Victorian era, Dame Ellen Terry was particularly celebrated for her Shakespearean heroines, such as Portia and Beatrice. A young talent and beauty, she left the stage for a while after she married the Pre-Raphaelite artist George Frederick Watts, aged just 16. An 1864 painting of her by Watts is in the National Portrait Gallery. He was 31 years older, and the marriage lasted only 10 months before she returned to her parents and went back to theatre work. Born to actor parents, six of Ellen's 11 siblings were also employed on the stage. Ellen appeared in her debut role as a child as Mamilius in The Winter's Tale at the Princess Theatre London in 1856, with Queen Victoria in the audience. Tripping over a wagon on stage didn't prevent her from going on to enjoy a highly acclaimed acting career. A notable part of her legacy was how she took on the male-dominated acting world by taking over the management of London's Imperial Theatre. Sadly, it was a financial flop. Undeterred, she turned to touring and lecturing to pass on her skills and knowledge. She spent many happy years living under pseudonyms in a cottage in Gustard Wood with the architect Edward Goodwin. Clementine Churchill. Behind every successful man is a strong woman, apparently. And certainly for Winston Churchill's wife, Clementine, 1885 to 1977, this adage is true. Churchill admitted World War II would have been impossible without her. Baroness Clementine Ogilvy Spencer Churchill, GB, to give her her full title, was a life peer in her own right, as well as being married to the Prime Minister. As a child, she lived in Berkhamsted, where there's a blue plaque commemorating her townhouse home in the High Street. As Clementine Hosier, she attended Berkhamsted School for Girls between 1900 and 1903. In the war, her ability to charm allies and her humanitarian efforts on the home front earned her not only the deep respect of her husband, but across Whitehall and the UK population too. Violet Cressy Marks. An explorer, mainly active between the world wars, Violet Cressy Marks travelled the globe many times over. Despite being married twice, she usually went alone. Modes of transport included sleigh, canoe, horse, cars, and on foot. Her brave accomplishments included being an ambulance driver with the Red Cross during World War II and securing a job as a war correspondent for the Daily Express. With primarily an archaeological purpose to her travel, Violet was also a capable filmmaker, photographer, and author with an interest in zoology, and she reported on politically sensitive areas. A woman of her own means, she lived when she was in the country at Hazelwood House, now a hotel, in Abbots Langley. She's buried at Langleybury Church. Margaret Murray. Margaret Murray was a British Indian who studied Egyptology, archaeology, anthropology, and folklore. Supplementing her college lecturer wages by giving public classes and talks at the British Museum and the Manchester Museum, the latter led to her unwrapping Knupnacht, one of the mummies recovered from the Tomb of Two Brothers, among the largest and most beautifully decorated tombs in Saqqara, Egypt. This earned her the unique status as the first woman to publicly unwrap an ancient mummy. She taught at University College London between 1898 and 1935, working in the field with leading archaeologist William Finders Petrie in Egypt and the Middle East, and was a trained nurse and a social worker in her early career. She wrote several books on ancient Egypt and was an early feminist. Her influential and controversial work in the study of folklore and witchcraft theory led her to be dubbed the Grandmother of Wicca. She lived in Welwyn, where she died aged 100. Lucy Kemp Welsh. Lucy Kemp Welsh was an artist and tutor renowned for her paintings of horses, particularly those in military service in World War I, and for her illustrations for the 1915 edition of Black Beauty by Anna Sewell. Her dramatic Colt Hunting in the New Forest is in the National Collection at the Tate. During her career, she had 61 paintings displayed at the Royal Academy. She moved to Bushey to study at Hacoma Art School before running it until 1926 as the Bushey School of Painting and then the Kemp Welsh School of Animal Painting. Lucy lived in Bushey most of her life, in later years painting gypsy and circus horses. A large collection of her work can be seen at Bushey Museum and Art Gallery. Lucy died in Watford, age 89. And the last of our ladies is Audrey Collins. Audrey was not only a pioneering women's cricketer, she also taught chemistry at St Albans Girls Grammar School for 35 years. Born in India in 1915, she moved to England after her father died in the Great War, when she was just 12. Her story proves that a turbulent childhood need not hold back success and fulfilment. A chemistry graduate at the University of London, her talent at cricket saw her play for several teams and become an English Test cricketer, playing in the 1937 Ashes. She was later elected chairwoman of the Women's Cricket Association, further driving the women's game forward. She was awarded an OBE for her services to cricket, and when she died, aged 94 in 2010, the England team on tour in India wore black armbands and observed a minute's silence in her honour. A founder of Radlett Women's Cricket Team, girls' teams in Hertfordshire are awarded the Audrey Collins Cup, a lasting legacy to this remarkable woman.
We're nearing the end of this week's programme. It just remains for me to thank our contributors, Caroline, Penny, Bob, Fiona and Sue, and of course John for the radio listings and Rupert for his nature notes. Steve will be here next week with News Extra, but that's all from me in April 2021. We close with Jacqueline Hines' wonderful recording of The Ashplant and Red-Haired Lass. I do hope you enjoy it. Goodbye for now, and stay safe.